Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome, Kimberly Woods, to Just Not Good Enough, a weekly programme on mental health. You've got such a fantastic life story, which is interwoven with all sorts of things, and I'm sure we're going to get to that over the course of the next hour or so. But you were born in Rugby in Warwickshire, eldest of four in 1995, on a council estate, which sets the scene a bit because of the drugs raid that I think you remember when you were there. But before you were born, your auntie won a silver at the World Junior Champs in canoeing.
Yeah.
Right. Wow. So it's in your blood. And you saw a video of that, obviously, and fell in love with the sport. And here you are now, and you've centered your whole life around canoeing and so on. Your first coach was your dad, who suggested that you learn to swim.
My granddad.
Oh, your granddad. Sorry, yeah. I beg your pardon. Yeah, which is probably a good idea, given the fact that you're going to be spending a lot of time in boats. Yeah. You then got your 50-metre certificate. And then since then, it's just gone on and on and on about achievements and winning things. And in 2011, I think you started with the National Lottery. Yeah?
Yeah.
And since then, you've gathered around 70 international medals, 9 individual worlds. You were kayak cross world champion in 2023. You were world number one at one point. You're Olympic finalist in 2020, which we will come on to. And you won 2 bronzes at Paris just this summer. But it hasn't always been a bed of roses, has it?
No, it hasn't. But I am still currently the world number one.
Are you?
So,
oh,
yeah,
well.
Still currently there.
I keep interrupting people, but I just find that staggering. You are the best in the world at canoeing in your chosen discipline.
Yeah. It's a dream that I've always wanted. And my teammate, Joe Clark, was world number one for a good amount of time. And one of the dreams was for us both to be world number one by the time we got to the World Championships at home. And then
how could you both be number one?
I just missed out. Sorry?
How could you both be number one?
He's a male. Joe Clark.
Okay, oh, sorry. Right, okay.
So we both wanted to be number one at the same time leading into a home World Championships. I just missed out. I wasn't quite there. But after winning the Worlds, I became world number one. And it's probably a good way of doing it.
Yeah, it probably is.
Yeah.
Is he still number one?
He is still number one.
So you are both number one.
We're both world number one going into the Olympics, which was really cool.
How did he get on?
Silver.
Oh.
Yeah, he was
How
going
many,
for...
though? How many?
Sorry?
How many? But medals.
Has he got?
Yeah. Oh. On that he won this summer.
Only one.
Aha, there you go.
He was 5th or 6th in his individual slalom. But he was Olympic champion in 2016.
Ah, okay. Okay.
But he was going for the triple in the kayak cross this year because he was European champion this year. He was world champion. He's world number one. And that Olympic gold was the one that he really, really wanted.
It's tough. It's tough. Bloody hell. So, you know, you had quite a tough upbringing, didn't you, I think? And because you're living on a council estate, and I don't want to do injustices or disservices to council estates, but they can be quite rough and ready, yeah? But then at school, you were bullied, weren't you, for quite a long time. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I remember it really starting when I was really young. I was probably about 8 or 9, probably when I even started paddling. And I was a very... out there child. What you see is what you get, and to be fair, even now it's what you see or what you get. I'm a very open and honest person, a little bit too much sometimes, but yeah, I think, yeah, growing up I was different. I kind of wore the same clothes every day, and yeah, it was a very tough upbringing. But my parents just did as well as they could for the times and stuff that they had. Very lucky to have my grandparents who took care of us quite a lot. And they kind of took me under their wing a little bit with the paddling kind of side. So I managed to stay away from, I guess, all the trouble that went on in the streets and in the kind of area that we were in. obviously I had some good memories as well, like having fun with my brothers and my sister, and fighting and normal kind of siblings do. And yeah, at school it was really tough because I didn't have much like emotional intelligence. And
but you don't at that age, do you?
No, but mine probably didn't come until maybe even much later in my years, probably after all the kind of mental health stuff started and I started to learn a bit more about myself.
Well, if it's any consolation, I probably started when I was late 50s.
Oh, wow.
Seriously.
I think people just don't really get taught in it, like how to deal with emotions at all. And I think that definitely needs to change. Whether it's like, I know parents having more understanding on how to coach your kids in a way, but also in schools, just kind of understanding like, just because you do something wrong and getting told off by the teachers all the time, like, isn't a good way of, like, being able to, like, deal with what's going on. And then, yeah, the kids just went absolutely ham on me, being different and fighting back and knowing how to, like, press my buttons. And I'd just fight back every time because
physically or verbally or both?
A bit of both. But I was always not taught by my dad, but it was like, you never... throw the first punch. Like, I never threw punches or anything like that. I wasn't that aggressive.
I bet you felt like it though, didn't you?
Yeah. There were definitely times where I wanted to have a scrap. And I definitely did have a few scraps with a few girls. And they always just kind of seemed to feed it out of me and loved getting the reaction. And I never saw it until way after.
Because you said, I think I read somewhere, you thought you were a bully's dream.
Yeah.
Because of the way you reacted.
Yeah.
You couldn't.
I couldn't not react.
But it wasn't that good in some ways, though? Because, I mean, I was bullied at school as well, right?
Yeah.
A bit later than you. I was sort of 13, 14, 15. And I didn't react at all. Because I was a coward, apart from anything else, because they were all bigger than me. You know, and I didn't know how to deal with it. So what you do is you go inside yourself.
Yeah.
And you end up actually in a worse place. So, but if you're reacting, did that help or...?
I guess it helped release some energy, I guess, that I had inside of me, able to like fight back. But it always just got me in trouble. Like, I was always the one that got like excluded from school and suspended and put on report cards when I was like 10 years old, which is ridiculous. I wasn't allowed to be in school for the whole day. And
yeah,
luckily, like my friend had she lived at the end of the school field, basically. So I'd just go to her house and have lunch with her mum until the end of school, until I got the school bus home.
Did you tell your parents or your grandparents that you weren't excluded?
Yeah, everyone knew.
Right, okay. Because a lot of kids don't, do they? They just disappear.
No, they get a phone call.
Ah, okay, yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah.
The secretary calls the parents all the time. But this is when I was like just kind of kayaking for a bit of fun and just learning the basics in the winter and things like that. I wasn't taking it too seriously at the minute.
But you were doing quite a lot of exercise, and one of the issues, I guess, I mean, so it was the issue for me, is I was overweight. And I used to comfort eat. Right? And that doesn't help. It makes you feel better, but actually it makes you feel worse because you become more of a target. I mean, is there any of that going on? You're doing all the exercise, but were you overeating? Were you putting on weight? Were you
No,
image shamed or something?
I mean, if anything, I probably didn't eat that much. Like, we were kind of like in an unfortunate position at home where like we didn't have that much money, and it was very basic, kind of the foods that we'd buy and like take to school for school meals. And we were on that kind of program where we got money for school meals.
Mm-hmm.
And felt very fortunate to have that. But I wasn't eating that much, and I never really thought about food in a way back then. But like, I was very self-conscious a little bit about my body because of how muscular I was, and everyone was just kind of like, that was just an in for anyone to just kind of bully me in that way.
Yeah, because you stand out, don't you?
Yeah.
You're slightly different from the others.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not good. But I also read that you in your family, showing weakness and being vulnerable and all those is, you know, you have to present this persona of being strong.
Yeah.
And yet that gets in the way, doesn't it, of expressing yourself. And I know it's very early, but many of these sorts of emotions and these reactions start at a very early age, don't they?
Yeah. My dad is always like, you're a woods, like, in a way that like you're strong, like show like everyone how strong you are. I think that's probably why like I always stuck up for like my brothers and sisters when they were in a bit of trouble, and like just kind of had this kind of protective kind of personality where like I had to protect myself and other people when it came into play. And then having canoeing, it was kind of like that was a good outlet to kind of go and release any frustrations and whatnot.
But you're on your own, aren't you, in a canoe? So making friends is still possible because you're in a club, but actually you're not. It's not like being in a football team or a netball team or whatever else it is that you might do. You are there on your own, a bit of solitude. Great being outside and on the water, and I know you're keen on all of that. But it's sort of contrary to what I would have thought you'd wanted to do. I didn't really make that clear, but do you see what I mean?
It's interesting because I'm such a team player now and I love being part of a team. But at school, I hated it. I did not want to be in team sport. All the girls that used to bully me did the netball, and the PE teachers loved me because I was good at everything, which was really useful. But I didn't want to do everything because all the girls and that who were involved in it, I just didn't want to be a part of that, and I didn't want to be a part of that environment. So it was a real shame that I didn't have that kind of collective and that group of people that I could kind of be involved with until like I was around like doing my GCSEs and picking them. That's when I think people started to just grow up a little bit.
What they did, the bullies did.
Yeah, everyone did.
That's interesting because that's the time I started to get bullied, actually.
Yeah. It didn't stop there because it kind of carried on a little bit when I was in university.
I was going to come on to that because you said you're not very intelligent. that doesn't mean anything to me, frankly. Basically, it means that you didn't like school and you didn't.
No.
And I get that. I failed all my bloody exams. I don't know whether you did or not, but I did. Because you were focused on sport, you know, but you got into a university in 2015. What did you do there? Which university was it?
Hertfordshire.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I made the move to go to Hertfordshire Uni to be closer to Lee Valley White Water Centre, which is now where I train. It was the London Olympic course, and made that move at the end of 2014. So it's almost 10 years ago now. Which is crazy to think, like, so much has happened in the last 10 years. Mm. Made that move down there. And, I didn't like school, mainly just the environment of it. But I had a really good rapport with the teachers. I knew I had to because they gave me time off school to go training. but we had a really good relationship with them to make sure I just did what I needed to do to get through school, basically.
Yeah.
I wanted to go to university because...
But it did. That is now, isn't it?
Sorry?
This is university.
Yeah. So, yeah, I went...
So you did enough to get through school.
Like GCSEs
right,
and things
I'm with you now, yeah.
And then, obviously, I kind of chose to do sport at university. So it was something I knew I wanted to do, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do outside of my sport, but I knew that could kind of open up some avenues of coaching and some development, and I wasn't a fan of the business and management side.
Is that what it was, business management and sport?
It was sports studies in coaching, development and management.
But that must have taught you an awful lot about how to look after yourself.
Yeah.
In terms of diets, routines, warm-ups, warm-down, you know, all of the sorts of things that I don't really understand. So in that sense, it was incredibly useful for you.
Yeah, and I think I learned a lot along the journey of my sport as well, going away on team trips. I probably learned more doing that and those experiences than I did in university, but that was my first real taste, I guess, of being an adult on my own, driving to and from, training myself, and my grandparents used to do that.
Were you still based in Rugby? From where
now?
No, at that point.
Yeah, I was.
So you were actually away, you're staying away in a halls of residence or whatever.
Yeah, in halls, yeah.
Yeah, that you see that, if you're coming off the back of a mental health condition, put it that way, doing that, moving away and living on your own, even in the halls of residence, but you've still got your own space, can be quite difficult. I mean, how did you get on with that?
So that was before everything kind of kicked off.
Okay. But you were still being bullied, weren't you, which can't have done you any good.
I think the so after there was a little break of it. I remember being around college. So after year 11, I went to college, and I went to school in Leamington Spa, which was quite a bit away from rugby. It took me almost like an hour and a half to get to school every morning, because of just the school bus, basically. And then went to college and in rugby, and kind of found my feet a little bit, and was really grateful to have those kind of people around me who had similar interests and whatnot. And then was really looking forward to go to university, because, I mean, I was on my own and kind of joining those little kind of society clubs and things like that. And but then I then realized I'm still quite different to everyone who I was living with.
How did that manifest itself? Why did you think that?
I think because I was taking my training really seriously. It was the first time I was kind of based at like a whitewater center, and that year I didn't make the under 23 team in my canoe class. I only just made it in my kayak class, and I missed out on the senior team.
We're talking internationals here.
Yeah.
Right. So you're in the international scene.
Yeah.
So why? You see, I mean, anybody, if I was sharing a flat with somebody or a residence with somebody who's an international something or other, I'd be in awe of them. I honestly wouldn't think they were any different. I'd be so admiring.
Yeah.
Because of the dedication that you need. But you didn't feel that or experience that?
I think this is where, like, my emotional intelligence would have been needed. Kind of understanding where other people are at. Like little things like helping clean up the like living space that we were in, just very small bits like that. And I think I was just really exhausted, and like after training and we do things and my social battery was very low, but I was never aware of how I was feeling. And like I'd never would have thought like, oh, I am exhausted. I would have just shut off and like shut out everything. And I think other people didn't really get that either, of where I was coming from.
Were you getting nutritional advice?
Not much then.
Really? Because you're in the internationals.
Yeah, but our sport isn't like massively funded. So we kind of like branch out to the people that we know a little bit. I was in between like psychologists, and it was kind of a weird time because it's like in the middle of an Olympic cycle, and I was part of the international squad, but I was still really young. It was only my first year of being an under 23. So I was 18, 19. And the focus was very much heavily on the seniors. So,
well, you could sort of understand that.
Yeah.
But you've got to build the talent coming through, haven't
yeah.
you?
I think we still get that issue today a little bit as well. I think it's really hard to, especially around Tokyo and Paris, like it was a very short Olympic cycle. And I feel very fortunate that I had the attention on me and the support there. But yeah, I think having that emotional intelligence around then would have been a lot better. But there was a point where I had to leave the halls to focus on paddling, and I just wanted to take it seriously and make the teams again.
Did you? So you actually moved out of halls to where?
To a house closer to the venue with a bunch of other paddlers as well.
Right, okay.
But I had to move out.
For what reason?
I think it was around February, March, and our selections kind of start end of March, April. And it was a point where I was kind of like, I'm just not happy here. I needed a bit more space, but also like people were going out, and there was like three floors of like four people on each floor. So like people playing music and smoking and like just an environment I didn't want to be in. And that no one really understood where I was coming from when I was
That's a really mature attitude, isn't it?
Yeah.
For somebody as young as you to say, I'm not going to do this. I mean, we must lose huge amounts of talent for the people who can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, they go to university or something and they get wrapped up in the stuff that you've just described, and their sport just gets pushed back. And it's that period, isn't it, really, where you're young and developing and you need to focus in order to hit your mid to late 20s where you're really going to be successful, that you've got to focus on, and you chose to do that.
Yeah. And I think a part of it was like I was fine with not going out and making those, I don't want to say sacrifices, because I love my sport. And
no, but you sacrificed it. But sacrificing, you're right, isn't the right word.
No.
It's you making a positive choice to do your sport.
Yeah. And when I have the other people who are living there banging on my wall at 11 o'clock at night because they're about to go out, but they're banging on the wall to disturb me, isn't a place I want to be in.
Well, you're back in a bullying situation, aren't you, actually? Not good. But then everything was going well because you'd moved out. You've got your, but you ended up with a serious ACL injury.
Yeah, so that was around that time.
Yeah.
I was still living in the halls when that happened.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yes, because you had to rely on your flatmates to get you into lectures and all of that sort of stuff, didn't you? So how did that all come about, and how did you deal with that? Because that, I mean, you know, you're a sportswoman, you're, I don't know, should I call you sportsman or sports?
Yeah, sportswoman.
Sportswoman, good. Sportswoman, you know, focused totally and utterly with massive determination and grit, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's cut away from you.
Yeah, so I didn't really understand what I did to start with. I was playing American football.
Yes, you say that's silly, isn't it?
It is, but I loved it, and I loved being part of a team and, like, kind of being in that environment without feeling different. And like, I kind of felt like, not the star, but I felt like people were in awe of me because I did canoeing and that was great, but I was also really good at American football. I was really quick, so I was like, I feel like people want me and need me, which was a nice feeling. And so I ruptured my ACL and then got told that, well, I then got told that I ruptured it because I had no idea what I'd done. And my immediate thought was, my coach is going to kill me because he told me not to do any contact stuff. And it wasn't like a...
But it's
quite ironic. But yeah, it wasn't like a massive contact thing that happened. I was just running. So it wasn't like even like quick change of direction or anything like that. It was just like a slight arc and the top half of my leg just continued going left a little bit. I really remember it.
It's the one behind the kneecap, isn't it? Is that right? Or it holds the kneecap in place or does something like that.
Yeah,
it's
I'm
around
not sure.
the knee, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's around the knee.
Yeah, yeah.
I ruptured that completely, which was a bit bizarre because there was only tiny little things around it. And normally when you completely rupture something, there's tears in and around the knee, but there was barely anything, which was kind of useful because they only needed to repair that.
Okay. So nothing else?
No.
Okay, well, just that.
And luckily I do an upper body sport, so...
Oh, yeah, that's true. No, but you...
I still use my legs.
Of course you do. You use your core, don't you?
Yeah.
And your legs are all... I mean, it's all connected.
Yeah.
It's all part of it.
It was an issue for my canoe. So my canoe, I'm kneeling down.
Yeah, I don't get that.
A single blade in my kayak. I'm sat down. My legs are in front of me. It's a comfier class with a double-bladed paddle, so... That's the boat I went to the Olympics in, the K one.
Right, which is the one where you're going down that, the through the hoop, through the barriers, through the.
The one
gates.
Where there's other people.
Yeah,
with
well, there's
me.
That, but also, yeah, which one are you kneeling or sitting in?
So I'm sat in those ones. So the canoe and the kayak, like you do the same thing, the slalom, and then you've got kayak cross, which is a bit like Mario Kart on water.
Yeah, I know, and I've seen it.
Yeah,
fantastic.
It's so much fun.
I bet it is. Anyway, I'll come back to that. Yeah. So, but at this point, though, because presumably you've been told you're going to have to be a long time off.
Yeah. Well, so I had, this was in February. I still had selections to go and to make the teams. That was 2 months, maybe not even 2 months, maybe even like a month and a half. So I had to try and force myself in a canoe position. Pretty much 2 weeks after I ruptured my ACL, and it was pretty painful, but I managed to do it and I made the teams again. I made the senior team for the first time in my K1 class, and like I think moving out of the halls was a really good decision for that.
Yes, it sounds
so. I went through the whole season without an ACL in my left knee.
Oh, so they took it out?
No, because it was completely ruptured. There was nothing there supporting my knee.
It's just good your job you're sitting down then because it's not weight bearing.
Yeah. So I wasn't allowed to run. that year. I had to just be careful when I was getting in and out my boat. Then we had, there was Olympic selections at the end of October, and it would have been a shock if I'd won the selections, but I was still there to then make the team, the senior squad for the following year. So we did the selections and went, if I don't make the Olympic team, I'll have the operation a week later. And then I had the operation.
Right. But then your mental health took a turn for the worst, didn't it? Go on, talk me through that.
So I went through a bit of a breakup at the start of the year as well, which kind of didn't help with all the feelings around that. And
A partner breakup, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I thought you meant mental breakup.
No.
No, okay.
Yeah, a partner broke up and then was on my own, really, and kind of dealing with it. Then went through the season, had the operation, and it was that moment where I realized I can't do anything. Like, I'm in a house full of paddlers and my training partners. They're all going training. I'm stuck here on the sofa. I had nothing to do. We recently then got two cats, which kept me having, like, good company, which kind of doesn't help now.
I'm skeptical of that, really, because cats are not known for their...
No.
Outgoing, let's do some, you know, comforting, those dogs are.
Yeah, I think we kind of made them do it, though.
Okay, fair enough.
I was like, you're coming here for cuddles. But yeah, I realised, like, I couldn't, I basically slept on the sofa for about a week and a half, 2 weeks, because I couldn't get up the stairs.
So that's not good for your health.
No.
Physical health, apart from anything else, because sleeping is not sleeping is not good for you.
Yeah. So then I can't remember fully when I started self-harming, but that was my outlet to deal with everything that was going on.
Yeah, because you even hid it as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I remember posting a video of me in the gym with long sleeves, doing like the kayak ergo, which is like a land machine for kayaking. And I watch it and I look somewhat happy, but I'm like, I'm not happy there. Like, I was happy that I was able to kind of move, like, in a kayak position, but I'm not, because I'm wearing long sleeves in the gym. Like, I'm hiding it so much.
But you're being very open and very honest about it now.
Yeah.
Why couldn't you be that then?
I felt embarrassed that, like, I remember seeing someone at school that they were self-harming to a degree which was quite severe. And I saw it and I was like, that's weird. Like, why would you ever do that? And then I remember thinking back to it when I was after I did it and like hiding it. And I was like, I can understand why people were trying to hide it now.
Yeah.
Because I just felt embarrassed that I couldn't go and talk to someone or deal with it in a different way.
But it's really difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean... And you actually went further than self-harming, didn't it, in terms of thinking about yourself and your existence, put it that way.
Yeah. There was a few times where I'd go and see the physio and I'd drive back, but I'll drive a long way back and I'd go park somewhere and I'll just sit, and not sit, stand like just on a road bridge or something, just looking down and just knowing.
You got that far?
Knowing. I wouldn't say that I was going to jump or end my life. It was kind of being stood there knowing I could and trying to like force myself to realize what I've got.
Did it work?
Yeah, but I did it a few times. Like, I'm kind of laughing about it now because I'm like, it obviously didn't work, but it worked enough for me to go back home.
Yeah. I mean, it's not about me, but I've been in exactly the same situation.
Yeah.
I remember being in Canada in a hotel, right? And I was jet lagged for one thing. And I came out of my room and the lift was there and there was a window here with the slats in it.
Yeah.
Glass slats, and they were open. And you could take them out. And I just thought,
it'd be so easy.
Yeah, I know it is. And a lot of people, I don't think, understand how easy it can be.
Yeah.
If you are feeling really, really shit.
Yeah.
You know, and you're in the deepest, darkest place that you can imagine. Actually, it's almost a relief, isn't it?
I think the thought of it is a relief, but you're almost like, I think for me, I put myself in that position to make myself scared and make myself realize what I've got. I've got paddling, I've got people that love me. But it's so hard to see that in that moment when you're feeling like at your lowest. It can just be like so easy to just switch everything off.
That's great strength of mind, because I couldn't do that.
No.
And I was in the sea once, and I had to get pulled out by my boys because because I just thought, you know, I was on the way down.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, and I knew. I mean, if I talked to myself logically, I knew that this was, why am I doing this? Because I've got, you know, well, in fact, I've got two sons apart from anything else. But I couldn't. I just couldn't think like that.
No.
I mean, so what pulled you back from the brink, if you like? I know you said you were just trying to scare yourself, but that's quite scary.
Yeah. I'd be there for like an hour sometimes, kind of knowing how easy it would to just like not feel the way I felt. And I think the skills I learned from my sport kind of helped me. And I was kind of like working with a psychologist who at the point didn't know what was happening. No one knew. And kind of like learn the skills from my paddling of being able to like think about other things and how I'd work around like a move or anything like that. I have to like take a step back and like kind of see the space and kind of look for different things. I think I was trying to do that. It was like I need to look and kind of distract myself or like think about other things. I couldn't tell you what I thought about. I think just at one point, I don't know, maybe I was just getting tired and hungry. And I was like, oh.
That's a good reason.
Think about food. And then, yeah, kind of had to leave. And I also didn't want people to worry for too long.
You see, that's quite common, I think, in people who do have mental health conditions. They don't want to worry anybody about it because they think that they might worry. So you're permanently thinking of somebody else. So there's compassion coming out of you. But then accepting compassion sometimes is quite difficult, isn't it? Do you find that?
Yeah.
So how did you deal with all of that? How did you find the compassion, or how did you begin to accept the compassion?
I think when I started to not admit that things were bad, but when my coach sat me down and told me that something was wrong. And it probably was about a few weeks after that when I realized, no, it's okay to actually like speak to my psychologist about it and kind of understand that it's normal to kind of, not normal, but like somewhat normal, and that it's not the first person that they've dealt with having these issues.
This is Craig, isn't it?
Yeah, Craig's my coach.
Yeah. Is he still your coach?
He's still my coach.
He sounds like a real guardian angel.
He really is. I've been working with them since I was like 16, 12 years now. It's a long time to be working with a coach in our sport.
Would you sort of put it down to him that rescued you?
Yeah. But also,
that was a very positive.
Yeah. But also the whole team, because I know that he went to a couple of other people just to make sure that he was the right person in the position to talk to me about it.
Ah.
Which I think is a very brave thing to do.
It's at this day and age, it probably feels the right thing to do. But why brave?
I think for someone to not know, but also want to help, I think he's also asking for help. Like, how do I go about this?
Oh, I see. Yeah. Ah.
Like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Am I the right person to do this, or shall I talk to someone else?
Yeah.
Or I feel like I'm in the right position and the perfect person to do this. How do I tell her to talk about it?
But he broke the floodwaters, didn't he, in a sense, because he got you to think about where you were and get you talking about it. Is that what he did?
So it's quite funny. I remember being in the, so I think it came about because I remember washing up at the house, and we had a few people over for dinner. And I like rolled my sleeves up to do the washing up. And then one of the girls was sat like close to me, and she looked over, and then I kind of felt her eyes, and I was like, oh no. Like, I kind of forgot what I was hiding. And then it was like a few days after that when Craig sat me down in this room, probably no bigger than this room here. The table felt like it was like 3 meters long, and he was like sat at the opposite side.
I shouldn't laugh really because it's a serious moment. Yeah, but yeah, go on.
So it felt like a really like massive room, and the table was long, but it really wasn't. And he was like, I've had a couple of people come up to me and say like they've noticed things, like are you okay? What's going on? And it was just at that point where I was like, I can't hide it anymore, and I burst into tears. And was just like, nothing's going right. Can't really remember how the conversation went, but I just remember talking about it and the fact that I'd admitted to self-harming, and that was the only way that I can like feel anything other than what I was feeling. So it was a very huge moment. And then...
Because it was your watershed moment, wasn't it? If I have to pardon the pun.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah, because from that
can
moment
on... Can you edit
on,
that bit out, please?
From that moment on, it was like we spoke to the psychologist about it and said like, look, there's only so much that we can do. You need to see someone else, because she was a sports psychologist.
Someone else was a sports psychologist?
Yeah.
Right.
I was talking to about my sport and like that kind of stuff. So then she were like, we need to get you to see someone else. And then that's when I went to the Priory.
Yeah.
Hated it.
Did you
hate it? Like, because they kind of like not interview you, but they kind of process you to see if this is the place for you, if you're that.
Oh,
so I hated it, and I was crying. The guy was kind of handing me tissues.
Did you stay there? Do you actually, are you a resident?
No. Because I lived quite close by, like it was maybe a 25 minute drive, closer into London, and yeah, I never stayed there. Which kind of like I went there no real expectation, but an expectation to be like, oh, they might put me on medication or something like that. And like I spoke about like the breakup I had and how that was like the start of it, and then like this like ACL injury and like just loads of other like that kind of stuff. And he kind of was just handing me tissues, and then at the end of it went, yeah, I don't think we'll put you on medication, but maybe we'll like schedule some appointments for you to talk to someone.
And
I was like, am I not ill enough? Yeah. How ill do I need to be?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it really made me angry.
Yeah, you've got, you know, I'm going to say multiple suicide attempts, but they weren't quite.
No.
But you got bloody close for it to almost be the same. And yet you're still not ill enough to be on medication.
And I couldn't wrap it around my head. I was like, oh, I'm just making it all up then. I'm just being stupid.
So that's the worst thing you can do to somebody who's got low self-esteem and thinks, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So then be told, well, you're wrong. You're just making it up.
Yeah, it wasn't a very nice place to be in when I left there.
But you did it twice, though.
So I went back again. I think once the kind of paddling season starts, I'm in a really good place. Like, we're in the sun, we're traveling, seeing loads of people, friends, getting good results. Yeah, I'm not thinking about all of that.
Yeah, I can see how that would get you boosted.
So
yeah.
I had that good distraction. But then in the winter, it was bad again. So I tried again just before the winter started, and I saw this lovely lady, and we did some like cognitive behavioral kind of therapy, touching on that, trying to like find my senses. I had a little box of things, like something to touch, something that reminded me of something that was a really happy memory, or like something to smell that was like really nice. Like just these little things that kind of really helped me along the way and understand how I thought and understand my feelings and what I was feeling. I couldn't put a word to the feeling at all.
That's so hard, isn't it? There isn't the language. I think women are much, much better at it. Men have got no language whatsoever. You know, when you go in a pub, we do not talk about my mental health, you know, although I force them to sometimes now. But, you know, whereas you do talk about your emotions when you're together, and that is so healthy, but you couldn't quite get yourself there, but you're beginning to now, aren't you, at this point in your life?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, I'm in a much better place to understand how I'm feeling, what I'm thinking, why I'm thinking and feeling these ways. And
you talk to yourself?
Yeah, all the time.
You tell yourself off?
Sometimes, yeah. But not in a way that's like you're stupid, like you shouldn't be doing this. Because I feel like I already make decisions now, having gone through that and like thinking, is this the right thing for me? Like, what's this going to like impact? And like I've grown up so much in the last 3-4 years. Like, it's kind of like ridiculous.
I find it's about heading things off before they happen. So, yeah. You know, when you're talking about you're reacting at school, that's an instant reaction. Yeah. And I do that occasionally. I get frustrated quite easily. And I was in therapy for a similar time to you, actually. And I resisted it a lot to start. Mm. I said, I'm an accountant. Oh, I don't need to do this. I can do this on my own. I'm a man, you know, but yeah. All of that. You can recognize that. And then therapy said, well, when is it? What's the bit that gets you to that? And there's this fraction of a second. It's a bit like, I guess, when you're starting your race.
Yeah.
There's a fraction of a second from which you can control your emotions. And sometimes I can, but most of the times I can't, and I flip over into that. I mean, is that, so you, what do you do now? Do you sort of see it coming or see that you can then do something about it?
I think I've learned skills to change my instincts. Because
that's,
my instincts,
that's tough, isn't it?
Oh, it's taken years.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it, I have credit to my sport and my psychologist around my sport, because I was still self-harming for probably like 5 years, like on and off. And
it's a long time, isn't it?
It is a long time. But when it was happening in breaks, when it started happening in the summer, that was when I was like, I'm around kayaking. I love kayaking. Yeah, I'm
still. And yet
you're
still, yeah.
And a lot of that was kind of based on my results as well. And that's when I was like, no, I need to get a hand of this.
Is that because Craig had intervened at that point, or you were thinking, this isn't right?
Both.
Right, okay.
I think at that point I was open enough with my team around me that I could go to them and say, like, oh, I've done it again.
So you talked to them about self-harm?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Because they were the only people around me when I'm away.
How did they deal with that? How did they react?
Thankfully, in a very compassionate way, and kind of understood, okay, we'll deal with this. Have you got things around you now to distract you? And one thing I actually still do today a little bit, I have a hairband on my wrist the whole time.
Yeah, I read about that. Yeah.
It's very useful anyway if I want to put my hair up.
That's true.
But yeah. It has other uses, and it's just like I feel naked without it. And it's something I just have on the whole time because it helps. See, and let me feel something else.
Yeah, I mean, one, I'm doing that with the wire, right?
I'm doing it.
Yeah. It's something to do with your hands. And
yeah.
It does strike. And I have a pen as well, which I like. I just,
yeah.
I'm not going to write anything down.
No.
Unless you say something brilliant, of course.
Yeah.
And I should write that down. But yeah, it does takes your mind off it. But is it, the winters then must be quite hard for you. Because there's a thing called seasonal affective disorder, isn't
yeah.
it? Do you think you have that?
Well, again, it's the kind of thing. So I'm like, oh, maybe I'm not doing any self-diagnosis, but like little things like that where I'm like, I must do. Like everything
there's
makes
a pattern,
sense.
Isn't there? Yeah.
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 But no one that I saw told me I had it. So I was just ignoring it. I was like, oh, maybe I'm just being silly.
But then you're training. You're on your own again,
yeah.
aren't you? Presumably. Although is the team.
But we have a training group.
Right,
and like,
okay.
We're like training together
okay.
and whatnot.
But I get a lot of it though, it'd be on your own, wouldn't it? Like running
yeah.
and
it's pretty
weights.
Gloomy in the mornings.
Yeah.
Cold.
Yeah.
2 degrees, ice coming off the poles.
Oh, don't.
It's pretty.
Don't.
It can
don't.
Get pretty tough.
Yeah. But then in 2022, just before the Worlds, you had a car accident. Did your ankle?
2021.
Oh, was it 21? Sorry.
Yeah, so it was
oh,
just
sorry,
after...
The Worlds were in 22, weren't they? No, 23.
That was
remember.
A home world championship in 23.
Right.
But there was a Worlds in 21 and 22. And
right,
in
so in 21 you hurt your ankle.
Yeah, so that was just after Tokyo as well.
Let's pause on Tokyo for a minute, actually, because you came 10th
yeah.
in the final, which I've read you put it down as being last. And I'm thinking, well, hold on a minute. An Olympic finalist. You're the top 10 in the world at that point, and you got distraught about it.
Yeah. I think
explain that. I don't... You see, And I know people set the sights really, really high, and you obviously do, because if you didn't, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. But, I mean, Olympic final, how old were you then?
I was 24.
Yeah.
I mean, no, wait, how old am I now? No, I was 25. I would have been 24 if the Olympics took part in 2020.
Okay.
Because
okay.
It was a year delayed, yeah.
But that's a phenomenal achievement.
Yeah.
But you didn't see it like that,
no,
did you?
No, I think if I'd gone out there and performed well and finished 10th, I think things would have been different.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't perform well.
So it's the performance that gets you, not necessarily the result.
I think, yeah. And in that year, that was the last time I really self-harmed as well in 2021, but just before the Olympics. It was my first race of the season since COVID, so since 2019. And there were so many emotions around it. I was like, I felt physically in a very good place. Even mentally, I felt in a really good place. I felt really confident to go out there and smash it at the first race. And I came fifth in both boats, and I got a little bit cheated by on one of them, and should have got a bronze medal, but a penalty was put on me, and that's a whole other story.
Okay, we can have a whole conversation about the penalty system, which I think is ridiculous, but anyway.
So yeah, and I was really upset about it, and I was trying to deal with it, but probably not in the right way of just ignoring it and trying to like pack up the trailer and things like that. And I had a bit of a heated kind of conversations with one of the staff members, and I got really angry. And
at them or at yourself?
Bit of both. It felt like no one really understood where I was coming from. And I remember closing the door to my hotel room and just letting out every single emotion. And I needed to do something. I needed to grab something just to like kind of let my emotions out. And then like I grabbed a pen and like with it clicked off and just kind of like not hacked at my arm, but like I went pretty hard at my arm. And the moment I did it, I was like, what have I done? I was like, I can't believe I like have done so much work in the last so many years. And in that split second, my instinct was to let this anger out and this frustration, this upset. But I went to my physio, told him, went to my coach, told him. I messaged my psych as well, because I was like, I feel so let down by myself that I've done it again after so long. And that was a time where I don't think I was seeing anyone at that point. But then we went, we need to see someone to help me top up my toolbox and remember the strategies that I can have. Because say the Olympics goes really badly, anything can happen. And I was really grateful that I was like, no, I need to do this. I need to go see someone.
But you're the broadly at the top of your game, aren't you, at this point, right? And at least Roger Federer said, you know, because he's such a lovely guy, you know, and you think he's winning everything, which he sort of did at some point. But he said, I think 99% is losing to get the 1% winning high, and you have to deal with all those lows. So how did, I mean, it must be the same for you. You know, you're not going to come away with a bronze Olympic medal every 4 years. Well, you might actually. You might even get a silver or a gold. Yeah. We'll get you back on here so I can have the photos done again. Yeah. So it is about dealing with failure, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that bit and the title of this show is just not good enough. So you almost always think you're just not good enough.
Yeah.
But when you think about it rationally, you bloody well are, aren't you?
Yeah.
So how do you deal with the... Is it anger outbursts and stuff?
I've moved away from that, thankfully, now.
Good.
I used to get really angry, even as a kid, as we've spoken about. But even like as an adult, hitting my boat and kind of breaking my equipment. And it's an expensive sport, so you want to stay away from that. but thankfully, I don't actually do it too often enough anyway. And I don't do it much anymore, I'm glad about.
Has it taken the edge off your performances, do you think? Or the opposite?
The opposite.
Has it?
I think the way I deal with things now, I had a lovely meeting recently, yesterday actually, and my coach said at one point during the Olympics this time, I said, I want to win, but I don't need to. And I think like that hit me quite a lot, because the fact that I've come to that place, like I used to think I need to win this race. like I need that medal around my neck, like I should be able to do it. And anything that wasn't that, I wasn't happy with. As an elite athlete, you kind of have to go through that phase.
Yeah, but, then come out but you get every it. 4 years, and you get one shot at it. You know, I mean, the anticipation and the adrenaline and the nerves and all of that when you're sat on this ramp and then they drop you in the water, yeah. You know, I mean, my God. That must be fantastic. But dealing, when you, the euphoria of winning is one side of it, but when you don't win and you really desperately want to win and that's what you're in the game for, that adrenaline cold turkey, if I can put it like that, must be really hard to deal with.
Yeah, and I think Tokyo is a perfect example of that. There was very little things I enjoyed about Tokyo. Like, it was my first Olympics and it was something that I'd been looking forward to for a very long time. And I remember being in the final and I was like walking the course for it, going like, yeah, oh my God, like I'm in the Olympic final, let's go, I want to win, I can win. Like, I had so much confidence and I was so ready for it. But then without the crowds there, I was trying to like get that adrenaline and like that feel of competition up from myself a little bit and a little bit from the commentary. But the guy doing the commentary is a British guy who does the commentary at some of our events. So it kind of felt like a little bit home and normal, which is a good thing. But I also, it didn't feel like the Olympics. Like, this was a big stage, like, to go out there and win an Olympics.
Yeah, because it's, I mean, the Olympics is the pinnacle of your
sport. It comes
around
in 4 years.
It should be.
We have World Championships and European Championships every year. Apart from, we don't have a Worlds in an Olympic year. So it was kind of like, unless COVID happens, and then we did.
Yeah.
So once I started making a mistake, I kept chasing for more. And it's all a bit of a blur. And I remember thinking, like, this is so hard. My head was down a lot. I wasn't seeing where I was going. I kept thinking about how, like, disappointed everyone at home watching is probably going to be. Like, they've either stayed up late or got up early because of it.
There you go, thinking about other people.
Yeah.
And yet, in that moment, it's about you, isn't it? And rightly so.
I hate watching that run back, because that's not who I wanted to be. And I remember crossing the finish line, being like, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry, don't do it. Stay strong. You're fine. You're here. Yes, there's loads of cameras around pointing at you. You're fine. But then there was a moment I put my head in my hands and I went, you messed up. And then I was like everything just came pouring out.
Isn't part of your recovery, though, about learning to love yourself and to deal with situations like that? I mean, you know, I personally find it really difficult to like myself. Right? Mm. And it's stupid. You know what? I can't be bad at bloody everything, you know. Well, maybe I am. I don't know. Maddie's not looking. How did you get across that line to suddenly be nice to yourself?
I think I wasn't really thinking about myself at all when I crossed the finish line. I was trying to, because of all the skills I'd learned from the person I was seeing at that point, for all of that. And I was very grateful. I just wanted to let everyone know that I was okay, and like, I'm sad about it and whatnot, but to not, I don't know, I didn't want them to be disappointed still.
So it's a lovely part of your character, then, that you're thinking about other people in your despair.
Yeah.
Wow.
And to have my teammates there at the bottom of the course. There's a lovely photo. It's actually my favourite photo from the Tokyo Olympics, because it kind of shows that through the heartbreak of that run and the disappointment of how I felt, they were there. Like, my coach was there, my teammates, Adam Burgess, and then Mallory Franklin. Like just being there and knowing that they were there, I was like, no, I'm okay. And I remember looking up and just seeing cameras all looking at me, and I was like, oh my God, I need to get out of here.
Yeah.
So then he was go get off the water and hide, basically. And I hid for a good 15 minutes, like, upset, and then I had to do media.
That's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah. I didn't have to if I really didn't want to, but the one thing I actually really wanted to do was go and use my platform to talk about mental health. And
yeah.
I mean, it was kind of like perfect, but not perfect, that my race went badly, because
yeah.
I was able to show like
vulnerability.
Obviously I was gutted and really upset about the race, but I wanted everyone at home to know that it's okay to have those feelings and to let them know that I was fine and I'm dealing with it.
Yeah.
And I've got people around me.
So you're not indestructible.
Yeah.
You've got vulnerabilities. And that, actually, that's the hardest bit, I think, about all of this talk about mental health and the stigma around it, is that people have to put their hand up and saying, I'm weak in this area.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I never, ever got over that.
No.
Up until the day I retired. Right? Mm. And my career has been, you know, up and down, and I've been fired from various places and for various reasons, you know, and that's bloody devastating, because I didn't ever learn to talk about it. So the fact that you're now doing it, and doing it even more, aren't you?
Yeah, as often as I can, because you can never not do it and it not be, like, received well.
I think, yes, that's absolutely right. Now, I mean, this is a program generally about business, but it's great to have somebody like you on here as well, to just to be open and talk about it. Because in business, it's really hard for people to talk up about mental health.
Yeah.
Because they fear for their career. They've probably got financial stresses. So if they lose their job, and I think the stats are that 70% of people either get fired or demoted if they talk about their mental health. You know,
wow.
And that's horrific, you know, and it's getting better, but we've got a hell of a long way to go.
Yeah.
So for you to talk about it openly like this, hopefully will help people.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do now then? Because you're 28?
Yeah.
How many years left have you got, do you reckon?
I've got another 10 years.
10? Really?
I reckon I've got another 10
really?
Years.
Okay,
so I'm still young in the sport.
Of course you are. So that's 3 Olympics.
Two more.
No, make it 3.
We don't know what's going to come in 2036.
Whatever it is.
I'm not sure. 3. I think 2036 is probably 36. A bit too far.
Okay, so
I'll be 40.
It's possible.
maybe.
Do something.
There's not many people that compete in their 40.
No,
that
is true. Particularly not in your sport. Bloody hell. But so how are you going to... I mean, you've been totally and utterly focused on your sport. And you've been unbelievably successful, right? And you've dealt with a mental health challenge. But suddenly that is all going to come to an end, isn't it? The sport bit is going to come to
an
end.
At some point, yeah.
So given that in between seasons, you find it difficult, and I know that's the winter and blah, 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 how are you going to deal with it then?
Well, I think I'm in a very fortunate position that I'm funded by the National Lottery, and everyone who buys tickets helps support athletes like myself to go out there and win medals, but also to like help give back and do things that help inspire people to continue that support. And I'm able to then like use that to go to Australia in the winter to get
shout.
Warm weather.
Yeah.
And yeah, I absolutely loved it this year when I went in the winter, and it really helped kind of spur on a little bit of motivation there. And I think, I mean, getting some vitamin D always really helps.
Mm. Coaching?
Yeah, I'm not sure about coaching. I think I'd love to give my time away and help that. I haven't got any qualifications.
But you could get those, can't you?
Yeah, it just takes a bit of time, and it kind of takes me back to school a little bit, having to do all of the assessments and things like that. And I'm like, come on, surely I'm qualified enough already with 2 Olympic medals. But yeah, I think anything that I can give back. My ultimate dream is to create a summer program where I can just drive around and let people like go canoeing, and teach them some things like at a course somewhere, maybe even like have a summer international program where I coach kids like in a river in Slovenia or something like that. I think that's the ultimate dream. How I'll get there, I'm not sure.
But well, I think you've got a really good chance. Because you're obviously very determined.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm a trustee of a college that looks after disabled kids, severely disabled. And they went skiing recently.
Oh, wow.
I know. I mean, I don't know how they do that. But canoeing would be bloody perfect for them.
Yeah.
Absolutely perfect. So I might get you roped
into
that.
I mean, para canoe are very successful at the Paralympics.
Aren't they?
aren't they? And they start in a couple of days' time, or even maybe even the 6th of September, so that's tomorrow. So they're going to bring home probably a few gold medals, for sure.
Well, we won 13 goals yesterday.
Whoa.
I know. So
they're doing incredibly well. And I miss Paris watching it all.
Yeah, I bet you do. I bet you do. Anyway, look, I think we've just about run out of time. Kimberly, it's been fantastic chatting to you. Thank you so much for being as open as you were. And I wish you luck in the future, both on the, what do you call it, track?
On the water.
On the water. And next time we meet, I want to see at least a silver, if not a gold, please. So welcome again for coming in, and thank you so much, and good luck for the future.
No, thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to Just Not Good Enough with me, Chas Howes, a radio show all about mental health. As a reminder, you can catch up with all recent shows on fubarradio.com.